Welcome everyone to today's Fireside Chat. This is number 426 for CH Networks. We're a project here at the University of Ottawa. Today is December the 5th, 2014. Our topic today is, I may look as if I'm feeling good, but sometimes I am and sometimes I'm not. So it's about the mental health of immigrant and refugee kids here in Canada. We're pleased to be working with the Canadian Pediatric Society in support of a project called Caring for Kids New to Canada.
We have two presenters today, Dr. Morten Beiser, and he is a scientist at the Keenan Research Center at the Lakishin Knowledge Institute at St. Michael's Hospital. He is also Professor of Distinction with the Department of Psychology at Ryerson University in Toronto. Our second presenter is Dr. Priya Watson, and she's at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health and is an assistant professor at the Department of Psychology, the University of Toronto. Welcome to both. Slide number 5.
Thank you. I just wanted perhaps to make a comment about about the way we've organized today. Priya and I have decided that we're going to ask each other a series of challenging questions. And the challenging questions will have to do with the particular perspective that we bring to the issue. Priya is a very experienced clinician dealing with immigrant and refugee children, and I'm an epidemiologist researcher. So we are going to challenge each other with some questions that will address each of these kinds of backgrounds. I'm going to start, and my first question to Priya has to do with the term cultural competence. You know, it's a phrase that everybody uses these days. I use it myself, and everybody agrees that it's really important in working with immigrant communities and ethnic minority populations. You know, I'm not so sure that I could define cultural competence, let alone recognize it if I saw it. So I'm going to ask Priya, since you're a clinician, how do you define cultural competence, and how do you apply it in your work? How do we know when to use these strategies, and which strategies to use?
Thanks for the question. So my first thing in thinking about cultural competence, I think, is that there's a whole series of assumptions that this idea is based on, some of which we don't look at very closely. And working with newcomer children has enough barriers. And one of the first barriers, I think, is the fact that clinicians often feel overwhelmed even by these constructs of culture and cultural competence. So in order to talk about cultural competence, we have to start by saying, well, what is culture? What is the thing in which we are somehow to be competent as clinicians? And the reason that I've written verb greater than noun there, which I found on a fabulous grammar website for kids, is that I think one of the most useful ways for us to consider culture, not just as clinicians, but really as members of society, is to shift our thinking from the more typical idea, which is that culture is somehow a set of characteristics which define a group of people, toward the idea that culture is actually a way of being or a set of practices. So Dot, you can pull up the next two, the content and process definitions, please. This idea of a content definition for culture is, I think, in fact, what a lot of times people are coding for ethnic subgroup when they talk about culture. And what they really mean is that there are a set of facts associated with a particular culture, and becoming competent in this culture means that you go out and you learn about these facts. So, for example, if I'm going to see a kid and I know that he's a refugee from Somalia, then I should do a quick Google search. I should look up Somalia. I should learn about the conflicts. I should see what the major languages are. I should acquaint myself with some of the norms. And then I will somehow be better positioned to see this kid. This is the idea when we have a content or fact-based emphasis for the idea of culture. However, what ends up happening, unfortunately, when we take that approach is two things, two barriers arise. One is the clinician right out of the gate has a barrier, which is, well, I don't know anything about this culture, so maybe I'm not the right person to see this kid. I'm going to say kid, meaning child or adolescent. That's my shorthand for the rest of this talk. they may say, well, I don't know anything about that culture, and so I'm going to try and find some other, I'm going to try and do some ethnic matching, I'm going to try and find a clinician who's from the same group, or I may have very limited expectations for what I can achieve for this kid and this kid's family because I know so little about it. And in other words, there's a whole set of barriers that the clinician can bring in if they take this content-based approach. However, in the process-based approach to culture, the idea is that rather than being a what, culture is a how. It's a way of doing things. And this is universal. In other words, we're all enacting culture all the time. The clinician is enacting culture, the patient is enacting culture, and the disciplines that we're in fact, have their own cultures as well. So if we move to the next slide, slide 6, please. So this idea that culture is a way of being or a process means that as clinicians, we're also implicated, and we can think of ourselves as being engaging with our clients or our patients. I'll probably use patient as throughout this presentation because that's the term that I use as a doctor. We're engaging through a set of cultural interactions. Now, this may sound more complicated, but in fact, I think it's much simpler. So what are these cultural intersections? Well, there's the culture that the patient brings. Then there's the culture of the family. And we all, when we work with kids and families, we all know that families actually have their own particular cultures, don't they? Their way of doing things. This is how we argue in our family. This is how we deal with conflict. This is how we eat our food. This is what we expect of our sons and daughters. This is what we expect of our mothers and fathers. That's a particular family culture. I've written physician here, really it's the clinician brings their own culture, their own sets of expectations for how things are done. Then there's the medical discipline or the care discipline itself. Depending on what field you come from, psychiatry, social work, child and youth worker, there's nursing, there's a number of different, we all come with particular cultures of our discipline which say these are our expectations for what our patients can get from us, this is what we should be able to give to them. And then there's the culture of the broader society. So we're all operating in this very diverse, mosaic Canadian culture, which means that we have multiple sets of expectations around how things are done. So now that I've made it sound completely confusing, what I will say about that is that all of those cultural intersections, if we pay attention to how things are done rather than what specifically exists before we come together in the room with our patient, we end up getting clearer information, we have a more established clinical alliance, and we end up getting much better clinical results. So when I teach cultural competence, my emphasis to the psychiatry residents that I teach is take a position which presumes that you know nothing, make that explicit, and then make it an exploration. So if we move on to slide number 7, you'll see that this is called strategies of cultural competence. And what I've tried to do here is distill what is it that we're doing when we're working across culture in a way that is competent. In other words, in a way that's going to help our patient give us the most information, going to help us get the best understanding of what's going on, and going to help us collaboratively develop the best treatment plan. And the three basic strategies are those of inquiry, humility, and advocacy. So inquiry is this active exploration, and the idea here is that you take what we call a not knowing stance. In other words, I don't know anything. I'm going to come in with as open a mindset as I can, and that's going to help me understand that what may present, for example, as abdominal pain turns out to be depression, or that what may present as truancy turns out to be post-traumatic stress. If I come in with an open, exploratory, active inquiry, and if I make that explicit with the kid I'm talking with, help me to understand, I don't know how this is done. What would this be like where you came from? What would the strategies be used? That active inquiry allows me to gather the most sophisticated information. Humility basically involves two things. One is the critique of the practice itself. For example, in psychiatry, if I'm treating a child with anxiety, I would be using psychotherapy, often cognitive behavioral therapy. Well, that is a cultural practice. That it comes from a specific set of beliefs about the self and the other and the individual in society. And I will often make that really explicit with the kid that I'm working with. I'll also acknowledge otherness. There's a kind of inescapable otherness between the clinician and the child in the room. Acknowledging that in a positive way can be very empowering to the kids that we see. And finally, there's the piece of advocacy. So if we move to the next slide here, slide number 8, this is inquiry slide, and I love this quote. Stephen Hawking, the greatest enemy of knowledge is not ignorance, it is the illusion of knowledge. And I think that's what we bring in when we try and inform ourselves beforehand about a particular culture. We think we know things, but we really don't. The cultural humility and advocacy, I really like this quote by Lawrence Kirmayr. He's a cultural psychiatrist based in Montreal. And he says, cultural humility is a willingness and ability to listen and learn from patients, but without shying away from the way in which culture and difference are used to stereotype and oppress people. In other words, by taking the stance of cultural humility, we're actively talking about social structures. And if we don't talk about them, they end up governing our treatment without us acknowledging them. There are so many barriers to these kids coming into care. There are so many things they're grappling with. This culturally humble stance of really talking about the structural inequalities or barriers is very productive. Finally, the last thing I'll say is that advocacy requires resources. There's no advocacy without resources. And so part of what you're doing as an advocate is you are allocating resources to this child. The first resource is your time. This is not a 10 or 15 minute screening interview. The second is information. In other words, one of the great knowledge is power, so understanding what's really happening, using resources that have been properly interpreted, etc. Finally, there's the resources of social capital and academic collaboration, understanding what are the social issues this child is facing and collaborating actively with the schools they're in. So all of those things combined make up what I describe as cultural competence. Okay, so now I have a question for you, Morley. You're on the hot seat. There's been a lot of talk about this idea of the, quote, healthy immigrant effect. And your own research, in fact, shows that immigrant kids have lower levels of mental health problems than native-born kids. So does this mean that when it comes to mental health, maybe we don't have anything to worry about?
Thanks, Priya. You know, when we first came out with the finding that immigrant kids on the whole had better mental health than native-born Canadian kids, it got a lot of attention. And I was concerned at the time because I wanted to make sure that that did not mean that we get lulled into a state of complacency. We should never be complacent. If immigrant kids are healthier when they come, and the data continue to show that, we have a responsibility to keep them that way. We have a responsibility to keep them healthy, just as we have a responsibility to all of our kids. And we have to keep that in mind. Another thing that's important here is that this is a general finding, that immigrant kids in general have better mental health than native-born kids. But what that can do is it masks a lot of difference among immigrant kids. So the next slide, slide 10, is kind of a simple diagram to show that. We have boys and girls, young people coming from all over the world. We have people coming from many, many different cultures, many different backgrounds. It's not the same for everybody. In fact, there are subgroups of immigrant kids who aren't doing very well, who are doing less well in school than other kids. We have the stereotype that immigrant kids excel in school. It is true, on the whole, that immigrant kids are more motivated to excel in school than native-born kids. That's been shown both in North America and Europe, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily all excel. We have this stereotype, but some are not doing well. Some are dropping out of school prematurely. Some are having all sorts of learning problems. Same thing with mental health. Although mental health in general seems to be at a high level, there are subgroups who are floundering and having difficulties. The things that perhaps are important to understand when it comes to diversity, and I'll ask Elizabeth to go to slide 11, please. A couple of sources of difference. There's culture. Well, how does culture affect kids' mental health? There are a variety of different ways, but I've just chosen one highlight on this page, and that's cultural distance. You know, there are ways in which societies organize themselves. They organize themselves according to a lot of core values. There are core values that have to do with how families should function. There are core values that have to do with gender equality or lack of equality. There are core values with respect to whether people should have status in society by being born into it, class system. And then we have the societies that stress achievement as a way of achieving status. People come from different kinds of cultural backgrounds. We have our own set of core values here in Canada. One of the things that we've found in our research is that the larger the distance is between the core values of Canada and the core values of the country of origin for immigrant families, the higher the risk for mental health problems among immigrant kids. Not all culture, though. I also talk about circumstance. Well, circumstance has to do with what happens when people come here after they arrive in Canada. There are all sorts of things that can affect mental health of kids. One of them is discrimination. Unfortunately, although we like to think of ourselves as a discrimination-free society, it's clear that we are not. And there is discrimination both on the basis of being an immigrant. The whole construct of immigrant is something that is getting an increasingly negative kind of valence these days. I don't know why that's happening. Well, I do. I imagine it has something to do with the economy. But there's a negative valence about just the idea of being an immigrant, and refugee even more so. And aside from that, on top of that, many of the families who are coming here as immigrants today are visible minorities. And the whole issue of visible minority, people are discriminated against on the basis of skin color. So that kind of circumstance can affect kids' mental health. And then I put category just because I wanted to keep the alliteration here. But category has to do with the kind of the mode of entry into Canada. If you come as an immigrant, you come on the whole as part of a family that's been very highly selected and screened. Refugees, on the other hand, are people that we admit to Canada because of their human capital, which is what we focus on for immigrants, but because they're in need of protection. And we offer protection to a certain small number of people every year. And there is a difference between the background of immigrants, the background of refugees, which also has an effect on kids' mental health.
So that's really interesting, Morley, because you're saying that there are differences between immigrant and refugee kids. So can you tell us more about these differences and why those differences are relevant when it comes to mental health care?
I want you to switch to slide 12. I find slide 12 a very poignant slide. It also illustrates, I think, the refugee condition. This is a picture of refugees, as it happens, who came here in the late 70s or early 80s from Southeast Asia, when we admitted 60,000 Southeast Asian refugees. Just look at the expressions on people's faces and look at what they've brought with them. Most of them don't have anything, but one person has this battered old suitcase which probably contains everything that they came with. And look at the expressions on people's faces. They don't know what to expect. They've suffered. They're being brought to a new country. They don't know what their status is going to be. They have no idea what's facing them. And that's the case for many refugees, that they come, they've not been selected, they've not chosen to come. They've been driven out of their homes, and they come to Canada. They don't know, often they don't know why Canada's even bothered to accept them, which was the case for the Southeast Asian refugees. They didn't understand the concept that another country might want to offer asylum. It's a very uncertain, very stressful situation, not to mention the kinds of horrors that refugee families have often experienced before they were able to escape their home countries. And kids, although we like to think the kids are shielded, they're not. Kids have witnessed terrible things. Many, many kids have witnessed terrible things. And if they haven't, they've heard about the terrible things that their parents were subjected to. So it's no wonder that refugees have a higher level of mental health problems on the whole than other categories of immigrants. In fact, there's a research shows that as many as 30 to 50% of all kids in refugee families have post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, having said that, Priya, I think that you would probably agree that although the prevalence, the rate of post-traumatic stress disorder is very high among immigrant kids and adolescents, it often goes undetected. But could you tell us a little more about your experience with PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder? Do you agree that kids with post-traumatic stress disorder often never make it into health care? And why would that be?
So a big focus of my clinical work is explicitly seeing refugee children. I'm based in Toronto at the Center for Addiction and Mental Health, and a number of community agencies know that there's a child psychiatrist there with a particular interest in refugee kids. However, that doesn't represent what's happening broadly, either in the city of Toronto, where most of Canada's refugees end up living, or across the country. I know we have people participating from across Canada today. I think it is true that the majority of children with significant histories of trauma, which have resulted in major mental illness, be it post-traumatic stress disorder, be it depression, be it anxiety, be it substance use disorders, do not get seen by a mental health clinician. And in fact, we have data that back this up. So why is that the case? Why, when these children are so obviously suffering, are they not getting assessed or brought into any kind of treatment? I think that this is, again, where the skills of cultural competence become so useful. If we go to slide 13, we talk a little bit here about post-traumatic stress disorder. First of all, PTSD can present very differently in children and teenagers than it does in the adult population. So depending on how comfortable and familiar people are with childhood presentations of PTSD, it may get missed altogether. A busy clinic, a pediatrician, a family physician, a busy nurse practitioner may not realize that what they're seeing is in fact a post-traumatic picture. One of the common things that can happen with children who have experienced trauma is that they can have regression. This means that they lose the developmental goals that they had. And this can get masked by things like low socioeconomic status, not speaking English as a first language. In other words, just how bright and competent these children were before the trauma is sometimes not evident to the clinician. So they don't even realize that they're seeing a child who has significantly regressed from their former function. There's also very different expressions of distress, and children, you know, we often think of children along these two broad paradigms, those that have internalizing, where the expressions of distress are inward, and those with externalizing disorders, where the expression of distress is outward. It's being, it's affecting others typically, or it's involved in a variety of behaviors which can be aggressive or self-destructive. So if we look at the internalizing, this is where you have the child that may be selectively mute, which is at a much higher prevalence in newcomer children. They just don't speak at all outside of the home. And teachers sometimes don't report that because their expectation is, well, this kid doesn't really speak English. I can't really expect them to be talking in class. In fact, children pick up English enormously quickly unless they have some kind of cognitive impairment. So if the child's not speaking to anyone outside of the home after being in Canada for 6 months or so, something else is going on. Children can become withdrawn. A child that's experienced a trauma has had a massive disruption in their trust, and they may not want to engage with people outside of their family. Now, the internalizing disorders often don't get referred because they're not really causing any problems. They're just kind of quiet in the back of the class. They're not doing much. They're not succeeding, and they're suffering, but they're not causing anyone else any difficulties. The externalizing behavior disorders do tend to get referred if they get severe enough. These are the children who become aggressive. They may have explosive outbursts of temper or may cry or be hard to engage. They may be truants. They may refuse to go to school altogether. And depending on how active and involved that particular school is, that may or may not flag them for referral or assessment. There's very high rates of substance use in teenagers with any kind of traumatic history. And so that's an important one to consider. PTSD often gets mistaken for other things, is the point that I'm trying to make. So that's one of the reasons that they don't get referred or they don't get seen. The other is that there are so many barriers, and we've spoken about this already. There are barriers of access, just the finances that it takes for a family to mobilize and come to a hospital for an appointment. People don't realize that that in and of itself can be a significant barrier. The lack of interpretation services can also be a significant one. Families not understanding what it is that's going to happen at the appointment, no pre-appointment psychoeducation, etc. And other barriers to access may have to do with conceptions around mental health. It's possible that the child's parents and family do not understand mental health in the same way that they do, that we do. They may not see it as a medical issue. So in Canada, when someone is in a severe emotional distress, we medicalize that. We say we should see a psychiatrist, you should see a counselor, somebody should look at you. Maybe you need medication. As in fact, in many other parts of the world, it's not medicalized at all. The cures and the interventions are much more social and at times spiritual than medical. And that can also be a barrier. Finally, the last thing that I would say is that part of what can happen with post-traumatic stress disorder, and this is a point we're going to emphasize later in this talk as well, is that the post-traumatic stress disorder, it's often the family that's been traumatized. So rather than thinking of a specific who gets this one diagnosis, if we can think of the family system as experiencing PTSD, that's often much more clinically useful. I'll give a quick recent example. About 2 months ago, I saw a young boy from a West African country. He was presenting with selective mutism, and his mom wasn't even aware that he was selectively mute, but finally he went into a daycare program after having been in Canada for a year, and the daycare pointed it out, and they were quite active and involved and suggested that she have him assessed. During the assessment meeting and when I spoke with the mom on her own, it became clear to me that what had happened was that the mom was in fact experiencing classic meets all diagnostic criteria, post-traumatic stress disorder. She was assaulted in her country and at political risk, which is why they were now refugee claimants in Canada. The boy had witnessed this assault. The boy himself did not have PTSD. However, he had a highly traumatized mother who, walking down the hallway from the waiting room to my office, had to stop and check over her shoulder multiple times because her hypervigilance was so severe. She told me, she's a very bright and educated woman, she told me, I know there's nobody there, but I have to keep looking because ever since they came and attacked me, I don't feel safe if I'm not at home. So this child, in fact, had spent the first year in Canada holed up in his apartment with his mom because she didn't feel safe to leave the apartment. So this was a traumatized family system, and the child was the canary in the coal mine. He was the one presenting with the mutism and the withdrawal. In fact, the treatment for this child was to get treatment for the mom because he was a very resilient little guy. He was engaged in the daycare. There were lots of things he wanted to do, but he was so anxious about his traumatized mother, and that was, in fact, the source of his mutism. So I guess the final point that I would make about PTSD is look beyond a single individual when considering that diagnosis to the family system more broadly.
So Priya, we think of post-traumatic stress disorder as being kind of the hallmark mental health problem with that refugees suffer, and with reason, because the prevalence is so high, both in adults and in children. But as you've pointed out, a lot of people experience trauma, and they don't develop full-scale post-traumatic stress disorder. They don't qualify for a diagnosis of PTSD, and yet we know that there is trauma in the background, and may be contributing to other mental health problems, it may be contributing to issues in school, issues with the family, and so on. So how do we approach a patient, whether or not they have post-traumatic stress disorder, how do we approach a patient in a way that's going to be trauma-informed, acknowledging the possibility of trauma in the background? What are the types of trauma that can go unnoticed by healthcare professionals? And what should we be looking for? What should we be screening for?
So this connects to what I was saying earlier about the idea that trauma affects the system and not just an individual. So when significant trauma occurs, people's psychology changes, whether or not it changes in the specific way that might meet criteria for post-traumatic stress disorder. If somebody doesn't have PTSD, it does not mean that they don't have significant difficulties with trauma. Trauma-informed care is kind of a buzzword now in a lot of different institutions, and people, many probably of the listeners, have had some exposure to this term and this concept. So this is slide 14, please. And trauma-informed care essentially presumes that there may be trauma with any person that you are speaking with in a clinical interaction, that this person may have a significant history of trauma. This idea, if you're working with newcomer children, is, I think, especially valid. There was a study done in Montreal about 10 years ago looking at both immigrant and refugee children, and it showed that both sets, in other words, the immigrants who had come with a lot of social capital and refugees who had come, you know, with clear histories of trauma, both sets had actually high incidences of traumatic exposures before arriving in Canada. So newcomers to Canada have high prevalences of trauma, and this is why trauma-informed care is especially useful. So trauma-informed care basically means that it's, again, like cultural competence, it's a stance that you take. It's an approach or a way of being more than it is a specific thing that you say or do. The idea here, you apply it universally to every patient interaction, both child, family, etc. There's a few things that you emphasize when you're doing trauma-informed care. Some of this is that sort of active inquiry and exploration, coming in with a position that you don't know what's going on, but you're interested, you're open, and you want to be educated by the patient and their family. You emphasize choice, control, and collaboration. In other words, you don't want to be re-traumatizing. One of the big barriers to people engaging in treatment for post-traumatic stress disorder, they may come for assessment and then dropout rates for treatment are very high. And the reason is because treatment sometimes is inadvertently re-traumatizing. We're taking control away. Here's what you have to do. Here's the medication you have to take. Here's the group you have to go to. Oh, you don't want to do that? Okay, I guess you're not suitable. And what can happen here is that trauma-informed care turns the tables on the clinician and says, the onus is on you to make this work. How can you emphasize choice? How can you make sure that the kid and their family feel they maintain control? And how can you collaborate? It's strengths-focused. So in other words, this isn't just pathologizing. And this is very useful when you're thinking about cultural competence as well, remembering that the very idea of diagnoses for mental health concerns is a cultural construct. It's one that we believe in Western Europe and North America and that we practice. But in many parts of the world, that makes no sense at all. And so when you're focusing on strengths, that makes sense across cultures. When you talk to a parent about what's great about your child, what can your child do, what are they good at, what are the things that you like about your child, and then you mobilize those things, you are engaging in a trauma-informed way with the child and their family. So now, Morley, I have a question for you. You said that the mental health of immigrant kids depends to some extent on where in Canada their families settle. So can you explain that a little bit?
Thanks, Priya. So this was, it's an elaboration of an earlier slide where I said there are three C's that I think about with respect to risk factors for kids' mental health, culture, their circumstance. This is an example of circumstance. Could you go to the next slide, please? Slide 15. And this is a slide that shows some findings that surprised me, so I hope they surprise you too. It's looking at levels of emotional problems among immigrant kids in four different regions across Canada: British Columbia, the Prairies, Ontario, and Quebec. And the higher the bar is, the higher the level of emotional problems. So what you can see from this slide is that in BC and the Prairies, the mental health of immigrant kids is pretty good. It's worse in Quebec, and it's still worse in Ontario. What is that all about? Well, I suppose one of the first things that springs to mind is, the old slogan during a political campaign, what's it all about? It's the economy, stupid. No, it isn't the economy, in fact, because we were able to control for that. It is true that immigrants on the whole, immigrant families on the whole, were earning higher salaries, certainly on the prairies, than in the other provinces. But even when we controlled for that, it didn't explain the differences in mental health. It was subtler than that. Why Quebec? Well, what it turned out was that it has to do with policy. And in this instance, it was policy with respect to language. I think it's no secret that the language demands in Quebec are probably more strenuous than they are in other provinces. And it seems that it's more difficult for an immigrant family who doesn't speak English or French as a mother tongue to get by without French, or at least with halting French in Quebec, than it is for families who are learning English in other provinces. So here's an example of where a policy at a high level, at a provincial level, may affect the mental health of kids. So we come to Ontario. It's not language, but it turns out that these are kids who were in this study. These are kids who grew up during an era of budget cutting. It was an era when welfare benefits were slashed, when public housing projects were canceled, and where homeschool projects were, for want of a better term, emasculated. These were policies that were driven by the idea of balancing budgets, of cutting expenditures. And I think what we're seeing with this slide is the long-term result of a short-term expediency, which was to save money, but the long-term result had an adverse effect on the mental health of kids. So I give you this slide as an example of how circumstance that's under our control. I mean, policy is under our control ultimately as a citizenry, has long-term consequences. So to go back to you, Priya, newcomer kids come with a lot of pressing problems: physical problems, social, education needs. Do you really think that we should prioritize mental health screening and treatment for these kids, given all these other problems? And, clinicians are busy people. A clinician who's not a mental health specialist, how can they handle that?
I think that's a great question. This is part of what I see of as my advocacy role, is to talk about the centrality of mental health in all other presentations. So if we go to slide 16, let's talk first about what the effects of trauma are. And I've written trauma here. There's other mental health disorders that we could be talking about, but if we keep the focus on the idea of trauma, here's what trauma affects. It affects a kid's ability to think, their memory, their attention, their concentration, their short and long-term recall. So unless we are assessing and treating this problem, we're setting kids up to fail in the school system, to say nothing of the language and other barriers that they confront when they arrive at school. There's social issues when it comes to trauma. These children can be isolated. They can engage in peer groups that can lead to higher rates of law breaking and truancy. There's a number of ways in which trauma creates social problems, broadly speaking. The academic problems I've spoken about in terms of the cognitive issues, but also things like grade placement. So newcomer kids have reported that one of the struggles that they experience when they come to Canada is being put in the wrong grade. Essentially, they're placed in a grade either higher or lower than where they were when they left their home countries. And this can have socially isolating effects. It can make the work much more challenging, and it can make them feel much more disenfranchised and less likely to participate in school. Then there's physiologic effects. So we know that we're getting some adult data in on this, which I find really fascinating, which is that children with an experience of abuse, which is a trauma in childhood, grow up to be much sicker adults. Not just sicker adults, but also even sicker teenagers. And by sicker, I mean physically ill. They are at greater risk of obesity, of heart disease, and in fact of premature death. They have a number of metabolic syndromes. So the mind and the body are not these separate things that we need to consider separately and decide which we're going to prioritize in a resource-strapped system. Not addressing mental health is like not doing vitals. You've missed something that permeates the whole physical presentation, will have enormous impact on how physically well this child will be, and will have a great deal of impact on how well they succeed in Canada. So there's, you know, from where I'm sitting and from where the pediatricians and family doctors who refer children to me are sitting, without treating mental health, without learning about the issues and then treating them appropriately, we can't achieve other kinds of health. I think that busy clinicians are going to have to screen. That's just the way it is. Not everybody can treat all things, but everybody can screen. So when should you screen? Well, you should screen when there's unexplained physical symptoms. You should screen when there's regression. In order to know if there's regression, you're going to have to interview the parent about how this child was functioning before. Screen when there's any kind of behavioral disturbance, either internalizing, withdrawal, mutism, externalizing, aggression, explosivity, substance use. Are there academic issues? Are there family conflicts that you become aware of? Is there self-harm? These are the cues to screen. There's a study that was just released by the Children's Aid Society of Toronto and the Centre for Addiction and Mental Health, where I work. It was just released last week, and it's called Hidden in Our Midst. This study is of newcomer youth, over 70 newcomer youth, who have experienced homelessness. And it was a mental health study of these newcomer youth. And two-thirds of these youth said that they would be most comfortable accessing support from either their doctor or the walk-in clinic when they were given a variety of options, which included teachers and various other institutions. So the kids are open to speaking to healthcare professionals is my takeaway from this. And in fact, that's where they feel most comfortable doing so. So the onus is on us as the care providers to do the screen, identify when there's something else going on. Next slide 17. These are just a few very practical things that clinicians can all do to set up for success. In other words, in order to screen effectively, in order to practice in a culturally competent way, in order to ask the questions you need to ask and to understand the answers that you're being given, there's certain things that you can do ahead of time that are going to make this much more likely to be successful. So I always say use an interpreter at least once. And the reason that I say that is because even though the mom on the phone can book the appointment and it all seems okay, if you're doing a mental health screen, you're going to be talking about subtle, complicated issues, which will be hard for the parent to describe to you in a second language. If you allow the parent and child to speak in their first language, then you allow them to express to you exactly what it is that's going on, and you're going to be able to distinguish more easily, is this sadness, is this a major depression, is this panic disorder? You need you need sophisticated and detailed information. So at least use an interpreter once. Parents will often say to me, oh, no, I don't need an interpreter. And I just say, oh, that's okay, I understand. I'll just do this automatically. Literature in different languages. So if you're going to be screening for mental health issues, a simple Google search will give a translated basic psychoeducation literature in almost any language you might need. Linking with community agencies. I said here create a list. So the worst thing is to be trying to figure out how to connect somebody on the fly. If you work in a clinic setting, if you work in any kind of institution, even if you're working solo in the community, take the time, take the few hours that it might take to create a list of community agencies that are going to be useful to the variety of different presentations that you see, so that in the meeting you can give this information to the family. Asking them to come back to a second appointment while you're researching what may be useful to them means that you're much more likely to lose them to care altogether. You want to give them something useful in your first meeting, because that may be your only meeting. In a clinic setting, I always say use the allied staff. The physicians, often because of payment models where we're paid based on how many patients we see or what procedures we do, there's a built-in disincentive for physicians to do some of this work. But allied staff who are on salary may have more flexibility in their time or can advocate for more flexibility. Case management is an important part of this. So it's not just about, is there a major mental illness, is there a major physical illness? It's about, is there housing? Is there food? Is there connection with the school? And those questions are all going to be significant contributors to this child's health and well-being. In order to support staff to do this work, I think that everybody should have an opportunity to take some kind of professional development on cultural competence and how to work across culture. This is such a buzzword now. There's so many different, seminar like this is just the beginning. The high number of people that enrolled for this tells me there's an appetite and an interest for this information. So take that back to your institutions and say, we need more training in this. Institutions have a budget for training every year. Here's the professional development that we need. And these are the ways in which you can screen and best set up for success. So I have a question for you, Morley. Your epidemiological research seems to be really relevant for public health and for policy development, but do you think it's helpful for clinicians like me? Give me a couple of examples of research insights that could actually help me in my office.
Well, just keeping an eye on the clock, and I think what I'll do is perhaps just give you one example, and that has to do with parenting. You know, I think every parent is interested in being a good parent. As I said before, though, you know, we have different ideas about parenting and what constitutes good parenting based on cultural values that people bring from their home countries. There is a style of parenting that's called authoritarian parenting, which tends to be a style in which authority flows from the top down, that children do not take part in any kind of a democratic process in decision making, and it's often a parenting style that's linked with quite harsh punishment, approaches to punishment, and also with a lack of demonstrativeness, a lack of demonstrating love and affection. If you talk to people, and we know of cultures where that is the norm for parenting. It's very different from the norm of parenting that we have evolved here in Canada, which is more, it's warmer, it encourages demonstrations of affection, it encourages a kind of democratic process, although parents are still supposed to create boundaries and enforce boundaries for behavior. Nevertheless, there's room within that for democratic processes to go on. That's Now, when it comes to working in a clinical setting, you mentioned before that the what of culture. So people may know enough about the what of culture to say, well, my God, I can't try to intervene. If I see somebody being an authoritarian parent, it's not my role or my responsibility, or it even exceeds what I should do to tell them, no, it's not working. That it's better to be a warmer, more affectionate, more democratic parent. People who have grown up with this authoritarian style will tell you, well, it's not that we don't love our kids, of course, but I don't have to give my kids hugs all the time and kiss them all the time the way I see other people do, because I provide for them financially, and that's how they know. There are two problems with that. One of them is that the kids see other kids getting hugged and other kids getting kissed and other kids getting praised, and they miss that. Another thing is that you can be a little bolder, I think, about approaching parents with the idea of changing their style, because research is now showing that regardless of cultural background, the warm, more democratic style of parenting is good for kids. Not only is it good for immigrant families, immigrant kids who have come here to Canada, but there's some research now that suggests that it's even a little better back home, that the authoritarian style, although it's culturally congruent, may not be the optimal style for raising kids anywhere. So I think that this kind of research can maybe help people feel a little bolder about giving advice, because I think every parent wants to be a good parent, and they would like to have some guidance about how to be a good parent. So I hope that that kind of thing will help clinicians. Let me go back to you, Priya. Immigrant kids are a lot quicker to take on the language, as you mentioned before, and habits and beliefs of the larger Canadian culture more quickly than their parents do. So how do you work with kids and their families to resolve some of the inevitable strains that will result from these kinds of differences in movement across generations?
So if we go to slide 19, this sometimes gets called asymmetric acculturation. So acculturation means shifting from the culture of your country of origin toward the culture of the country you now live in, like Canada. And we have any clinician can tell you, and now there's research that shows that kids do this a lot faster than their parents. And in fact, sometimes parents really dig in their heels because they're trying to preserve something of their own past and history. So they say to the kid, no, this is the way we're going to do things. These are our traditions. We're not giving them up. Here are our expectations for you. And if the parent's expectations are very different from the kids, then you have something, you can have significant family conflict. In that study that I mentioned earlier, the Hidden in Our Midst study, two-thirds of the kids, of the newcomer kids who ended up homeless, said that the reason they were homeless was family conflict. And in fact, homeless kids generally will say that. It's a breakdown of the family system that often results in homelessness for a kid, for a teenager or a child. So these family conflicts are serious and they're important to address. You need family-based interventions to do this, and this means that you need parental buy-in. You can't effectively help a kid without changing a family system. It just always is the case that the family changes as the child changes. And sometimes if you decide that the issue is, as you said, Morley, something like harsh parenting practices, you need parental buy-in. It's not sufficient to just say, well, you know, you should really do this and then your kid will feel happier. Because happiness as a goal is also a cultural construct. Particularly people that have had to scrabble to get out alive from whatever country they're in, they may have different agendas than just the happiness of their child. They may be interested in economic security or academic success. And so I use those strategies to try and achieve parental cooperation and buy-in, because I also want the kid to succeed academically. I remember seeing a child, a refugee child, and explaining to the parents the change that doing family therapy was going to result in much better grades. And it did. And using that kind of strategy can be quite useful. On page 20, I've just listed this idea of the constant stresses. These are the stresses on the child and family, and awareness of this can be so useful when you're engaging with a family system. The idea that everybody's in a role transition, sometimes the child most of all, they've gone from being a child, they have to grow up very fast. All of a sudden they're interpreting for their parents everywhere, they're the ones talking to the landlord, they're the ones negotiating the electricity bill, because they're the ones who quickly acquired the language. The parental stresses, the high rates of trauma in the parents themselves, the economic insecurity, being placed in the wrong grade at school, family separation, the fact that significant family members have often been left behind when there's a refugee child. And as you've mentioned, racism and discrimination in Canada. And it's really, I think, the onus is on us to explicitly talk about that. That's what cultural humility, as one of the strategies of cultural competence, allows you to do. On page 21, I make the point here that if you don't address family conflict, you end up with children that are in a much worse place. And it leads to homelessness, it leads to substance abuse, school dropout, anxiety disorders, depression, self-harm, ongoing severe family conflict, of which these families can be at a much higher risk due to traumatized parents and the stresses I listed in the slide before. These ongoing conflicts are very important to recognize and to find some way to assist with. So, last question is one that I have for you, Morley, and that's that clinicians are treating patients and families, but we also have this advocacy role that we've been talking about really throughout the hour as professionals and also as citizens. Can you give me some examples of how research can inform advocacy?
I'm a big fan of informed advocacy, advocacy that is based on research and knowledge. One of the reasons I wanted to present the data about regional differences, and I see that somebody's asked a question, so we'll come back to that, but I wanted to present that because it's an example of how, as professionals and as citizens, we can use information like that, data like that, to try to influence policy and to improve policy. But one thing that I would like to suggest, actually maybe we could switch to slide 22. One thing I would really like to suggest, that has to do with what Priya talked about as acculturation, the taking on of the culture of Canada. A good colleague of mine, John Berry, has talked a lot about that and studied it a great deal. One of the things that John has suggested is that it's important for kids to be able to retain their culture of origin at the same time as incorporating the larger Canadian culture. And there's no inherent conflict in that, or there needn't be. You can be proud of your past, you can be proud of your parents' culture, you can feel a sense of attachment to your parents' culture at the same time as you take on some of the characteristics of Canadian culture. And what John has suggested is that the best acculturative strategy is one in which kids do both, that they take on the larger Canadian culture and retain their own heritage culture. Other kinds of acculturation strategies, you may reject the Canadian culture and stick to your heritage culture, which would be called isolation. That's not as good a strategy. Or you might buy in totally into the Canadian culture and reject your past. That's called assimilation. That's also not such a great strategy. The best strategy, theoretically, is the one where kids can combine both. Well, we have research actually that shows that. I mentioned before the increased risk for mental health when you have large cultural distance between the home country and Canada. Kids who are able to incorporate both the cultures actually can overcome that mental health risk. So what does that mean from an advocacy point of view? We have a long-standing tradition of multiculturalism in Canada. It's been a source of pride to us. More recently, it's come under a lot of attack, and there have been other countries that have declared multiculturalism a failure. I want to propose that before we accept that kind of thing, we should look at it very carefully, because multiculturalism, it turns out, stresses that. It stresses the idea of keeping your and honoring your heritage culture at the same time that you incorporate the larger Canadian culture. So it's not just perhaps appealing as an ideology, but I think we can say that it works. And that's another reason for being able to support that as a policy. And that's what I think is also important for us in our role as advocates, citizen advocates, professional advocates. I think that brings us to the end of what we'd prepared to talk about with each other. So perhaps, Dot, Elizabeth?
That was a fabulous presentation. Thank you so much. The first set of questions that came in was about slide number 15. Are the differences in this slide statistically significant?
Yes, they are. Ontario was significantly higher levels of mental health problems than Quebec, which in turn was significantly higher than the other two regions.
Was this controlling for proportion of immigrant kids in each province?
A quick answer, no.
Where can they find the source for the findings?
Thank you for that question. Actually, I meant to point out on slide 22, there is a website that's given there, www.nccys.com. NCC, the acronym stands for New Canadian Child and Youth Study. It's a national study of immigrant and refugee kids, their development, their health, and their mental health that we've been carrying out for a number of years. And the paper that I'm citing is on that website, plus a lot of other research papers that have to do with the mental health and the physical health of immigrant and refugee kids. So it's nccys.com.
Someone's interested to know the sample size used for that research.
Right. We had approximately 500 children in each of the regions, so a total sample size of approximately 2,000. I should also add that the samples were fairly homogeneous with respect to ethnic background. So we had three different ethnic groups represented, because they came from the top immigrant sending regions at the time we did the study. So it's Hong Kong Chinese, it's mainland Chinese, and it's Filipino. So each of the groups, each of the four samples was composed of those three, of kids from those three ethnic backgrounds, and the total sample size was approximately 500 in each of those groups. Well, there's one more question, whether this referred to immigrant children or to native-born kids. So let me answer that one quickly. The sample was either kids who came to Canada as immigrants, or who were born into an immigrant family who had been in Canada 10 years or less. So it's both. It's both kids who are born here and kids who came themselves as immigrants, but if they were born here, they were born into families who were recent immigrants.
Remember, there was a question about, was this controlling for the proportion of immigrant kids in each province? And your quick answer was no. So the comment back was, thanks for your response. I think the finding is a bit hard to interpret then if it didn't control for the proportion of immigrant kids, since that might be contributing to the differences.
I think that's a great question, and if we had been able to do that, it would be a great idea. I think that there is a notion, more than a notion, it's a concept, that the presence of like ethnic communities, like immigrant communities, is supportive, and I'm assuming that that's behind this question. And I think it's a great question. We were not able to control for that. Or to use that as a variable. There are lots of possible explanations as well as the ones that I've given, but what I've told you is what we've been able to unearth so far. It's a huge data set, and there's lots of riches in there to mine.
Thanks. What's your view on standardized testing in school settings with refugee or immigrant children or teens, specifically those who have been in country less than 4 years? This is an issue that arises frequently due to the often seemingly underdeveloped skills in the classroom.
This is Priya. I'll respond. So if I understand the question, they're saying that the testing is done because the child doesn't seem to be flourishing academically, as opposed to the child just doing routine standardized testing that everybody has to do. So, you know, every certain grades, they all have to do certain tests. So I'll answer both of those. When it comes to the, at least in Ontario, I don't know if this is true in every province, although I suspect that it probably is. There are at you know certain grades, like grade 3, for example, all the kids in public school have to take a test, a standardized test, and the idea that this is somehow providing a report card on the schools. And what I find is that the test benefits. Well, it's arguable if it benefits anyone, but the person it benefits least is the child. Those kinds of province-wide standardized tests, which are sort of created in order to determine if schools or school districts are up to snuff, generally are stressful, they distort the curriculum, and the children don't benefit directly. They never get any feedback on their own performance, etc. If the testing that's being asked about is like psychoeducational testing, which is essentially testing for a learning disorder or cognitive issue because the child doesn't seem to be benefiting. I actually am in favor of that, provided that it's done appropriately. So I would say yes and. So I think it's great because often kids have come from places where learning issues were not, there just weren't the resources to assess their learning, and they may come with some learning issues. However, in the presence of a major mental disorder, which is as yet untreated, the testing is not valid. So if the child doesn't have anxiety, depression, PTSD, or any major mental disorder, and doesn't seem to be flourishing, and has been in Canada, say, a year or two, I would say absolutely do the testing, because there may be an undetected learning issue, which the child would really benefit from having that assessed. If, however, for example, the child has anxiety, that will really distort the results of the testing. I find that language issues don't tend to be as much of an issue for most children once they've been in Canada, certainly by 2 years. In my experience, I don't know what data there are, and I'm sure there are exceptions, but for the most part, they're thoroughly fluent at that point.
I want to go on to some other questions that were around parenting. How did you assess how different the values of the other country is from Canadian values? Are there ways to measure cultural differences across countries objectively?
That's a great question. It was one that I wrestled with for a long time. There is something called the World Value Survey. Believe it or not, where there are surveys that are administered every couple of years in many different countries to large samples, and they deal with core values. They actually measure things like belief in gender differences or gender equality. They measure things such as deference to authority versus non-deference to authority. So it's possible to get a score on these kinds of dimensions from many countries. And as it turned out, we could get a score for most of the countries that were in our sample. Most of the countries of origin for the families in our sample from the World Value Survey. Canada also gets a score on each of these dimensions. So what I did was simply to subtract one from the other, and that gave me a distance score between Canada and whatever the source country was. And then what we did is we used those distance scores and correlated them or examined them with respect to the mental health levels of the kids.
What do you think about blending different parenting styles, or should people stick to one parenting style?
What I generally say in response to that when I'm working clinically with families is that you generally need to be a different parent for each kid. So the onus is on the parents to adapt their parenting style in a way that's going to be the best fit for the child. Because often I'll see parents, and if we're doing parenting work, they'll say, well, you know, that her brother doesn't have any of these problems, and I'm exactly the same with him, and he's fine, and therefore the problem is, you know, is this child. And unfortunately, one of the many complexities of parenting is that it requires that you be a different parent for each child that you have. Now, you add to that a parent that's trying to grapple with a whole new cultural system and how to do that effectively, and it's a big burden. It's a lot of stress. So I'll take a common example that people encounter. They encounter a parent that comes from a culture where spanking your child is not seen as remotely abusive or problematic even. It's just good parenting, it's effective discipline, and they would never dream that anything that they were doing was problematic. They come to Canada, and the clinician screens, and does your mom hit you? Yes, she hits me all the time. What does she hit you with? Well, she hits me with a wooden spoon on my bum. Well, technically, we're into a problem area by Canadian norms and standards, and by at least in Ontario, by the standards of the Children's Aid Society. This is the kind of complexity that we're asking parents, well-intentioned, loving, well-meaning parents, to deal with. This thing that you did back where you came from, which you've never seen a problem with, all of a sudden you're in a society where even the legal system is telling you that's not okay. So there's a lot of burden on the parents. And what I find is emphasizing that the parenting has to be eclectic, that it has to involve mixing styles, and that it will likely change over time as the child changes over time, is exactly the way to go. Because then you're normalizing for the parents that this is a moving target that's going to require a lot of flexibility on their part. If you can normalize that as the clinician, you lighten the load a little bit in terms of what they're grappling with.
What do you believe are some factors of resiliency for refugee children?
It's a great question, and something that we really need to know more about. The issue of resilience is something that's really just starting to be talked about, and resilience has also become a buzzword. What is resilience? Well, I think that there are a couple of sources of resilience. We can think about internal sources of resilience. We can think about social sources of resilience. I think one of the things that helps explain the superior mental health of many immigrant kids, despite all the challenges, and perhaps of refugee kids as well, is the family. Despite the fact that immigrant and refugee kids tend have a high risk of living in poverty, below the so-called low-income cutoff for Canada, more than a third live in terrible poverty. Despite that, they seem to somehow be able to keep mentally healthy. Why is that? Do with the fact that immigrant and refugee families, when they're able to stay together, are more stable. They, despite poverty, the families tend to stay together. It's a different phenomenon than poverty in the larger population, which is more likely to be characterized by single-parent families, by abusive families, and the rest of it. There's something about the family structure that I think is a source of resilience. I think another source of resilience has to do with what I was talking about before, the ability of the child to hang on to the ethnic background, the ethnic history, to hang on, but at the same time to incorporate the larger Canadian society. I think that's a source of internal resilience, this identity and the ability to forge a bicultural identity that takes advantage of both. Those are only two thoughts about two possible sources of resilience. Priya?
Yeah, so I think I like that question very much, because sometimes these presentations, because we're trying to really talk about the issues, we can inadvertently underemphasize the question of resilience. Generally speaking, these children and their families are among the most resilient humans on the planet, being able to mobilize what it takes to get to another country as a refugee means that you have enormous stores of resilience. You have skills, you have toughness, you have all kinds of things that are going to be very protective in the long haul. What I like about the idea of trauma-informed care is the idea of it being strengths-focused, as it said on the slide about trauma-informed care. This is part of what that gets at, is that you're actually specifically identifying and recruiting the specific resiliences of the child that you're working with. That's a very important part of the clinical work.
Beautiful. Thank you. Slide 17, you mentioned the importance of using an interpreter at least once. However, we don't always have certified interpreters. Any thoughts on that?
Yes, I do. That's a really good point. Thank you for raising that. That's okay. I think it's fine that you if you can get a certified interpreter, great. If you can't, that's okay too. Poll your institution if anybody speaks the language so that there's somebody who's within the circle of care could do the interpretation for you. Alternately, see if they can bring in somebody who could do that they're comfortable doing the interpretation. So often, for example, religious institutions in various communities informally do a lot of this settlement work, and they help families settle, and they help them, you know, find housing, and they do a lot of this kind of social piece. And if there's somebody, for example, in their church, temple, mosque, whatever it may be, who they feel comfortable with bringing in as an interpreter, ask them to do that. That person would likely have been in Canada all their lives, or at least longer, speaks English fluently, and can do the interpretation. So I think don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. Get any kind of interpretation you can, because you will really enormously benefit.
Thank you. When working with immigrant youth who do not want parents involved or to know about the counseling, yet a lot of their stresses are caused by parental pressure and expectations, any suggestions for how to decrease the youth's reluctance to involving parents, or how to then work with the youth? Any comments on that? And that will be our last question for now.
What I think it's you play the long game. So you start out, this is probably something every clinician knows, I mean, engagement is the number one. So you really engage with the youth, you let them set the agenda to some extent. This is not just true of the refugee, I mean, this is a thing with adolescents generally. Most adolescents that I work with have a pretty strong degree of reluctance for their parents to be very involved or informed. Often they have misconceptions about what that would mean. They're afraid that you're going to tell them everything, tell the parents everything, and so they'd rather you just didn't see their parents at all. They're not sure what the limits of confidentiality are. They worry that they're going to get in trouble after a session, that the parent will, you'll speak to the parent and then they'll go home and get in trouble for whatever it was that the parent heard in the session. So that they have a variety of anxieties or concerns, so thoroughly unpacking those and understanding them can be very useful. I always say right out of the gate, this is your decision, because it is, legally. It is their decision. Unless they don't have capacity, this is up to them. So I always say, this is in your hands. This is that whole idea of control. You're going to be the one who makes this decision. Let's talk about why you're feeling the way you feel. And let's really unpack that. And I might see a kid for a couple of months, and then I might say, on a very specific issue, gosh, I'd love to talk to your mom about this. And the kid might say, I don't want my mom to come in. And I'll say, okay, what if we just did a little thing? I'll be me, you be your mom. I'll tell you what I would say to your mom. You tell me what you think your mom would say back to me. And let's just hash it out. And often when they can see it enacted like that for them, they realize that it's not so bad. And that's a clinical strategy that I use a lot. And I find it's pretty useful, actually. It tends to reduce their anxiety. And I think also recognizing that sometimes, in some cases, you're just never going to get that parent in the room, sometimes because the parent doesn't want to come. And then you just do the best workaround that you can.
Thank you. Now, over to Elizabeth Moreau from Canadian Pediatric Society for closing remarks.
Thanks very much, Dot. Just on behalf of the Canadian Pediatric Society, thanks to everyone for participating. Thank you so much to Morley and Priya for an absolutely fantastic presentation, both in terms of the content and the format. I think it was innovative, creative, and just terribly, terribly engaging. So thank you so much. I just want to recognize the Canadian Institutes for Health Research that made this webinar possible, and let you know that this is the third in a series of six that we're hosting on the health and well-being of immigrant and refugee kids. The next one is on January 27th on child development. So we hope we'll see a lot of you then. and for the next two that we're having in 2015. You have a link if you're on Adobe Connect to a survey, and an email will be going out to Dot. So if you could take a couple of minutes to let us know what you thought and how we might do more of these in the future, that would be very helpful. And then finally, just to encourage you to visit Caring for Kids New to Canada, which has a ton of additional resources on mental health, on using interpreters, on PTSD, and on much, much more. So, and let us know what you think of the website. So thank you very much.
Now over to our two presenters for any last thoughts they'd like to leave today.
I just want to say thank you, and it's been a pleasure, and I'm so encouraged by the number of participants and the number of institutions across the country that have signed up for this. That really, to me, is enormously encouraging, and it's really been a pleasure and a privilege to do this, to participate in this, and a lot of fun to do it with Morton as well. And just, to really encourage everyone to complete the evaluations, because Morton and I will read those closely to have a look to see what your impressions were and if there are any areas for improvement for us in terms of getting these ideas across. So we just want to thank you very much.
The last thoughts really echo what's been said before. I think we're a relatively small community still that cares about immigrant and refugee kids. We're a growing community, and that's great. And anything that we can do to make that community grow and make our voices heard, we should be doing it. And thank you very much to the Canadian Pediatric Society for helping make that happen.